next, as she's setting up, will be Heather Sparling, working through pain, cultural trauma, and disasters along with the pandemic.
In a 2004 essay, Toward a Theory of Cultural Trauma, sociologist Jeffrey Alexander argues that no events are inherently traumatic. Rather, trauma is attributed to particular events. Events are defined as traumatic, quote, not because of their actual harmfulness or their objective abruptness, but because these phenomena are believed to have abruptly and harmfully affected collective identity, end quote. Alexander defines a social process of cultural trauma by which particular events are given significance as traumas negatively impacting a particular collective. The process starts when a group makes a claim that a particular event resulted in some fundamental injury or destructive social process requiring reparation and restitution. Consequently, not every tragedy becomes a cultural trauma. As many of you know, I've been studying Atlantic Canadian disaster songs for the last couple of years. My encounter with the concept of cultural trauma inspired me to consider what roles songs in my database might play in the cultural trauma process. Did they help to transform events from tragic stories into cultural traumas? Does their existence indicate or predict cultural traumas in any way? In this paper, I will focus on Westray, the 1992 Nova Scotia mining disaster that killed 26 miners. However, I will also make reference to two other disasters mentioned in my abstract, the 1914 sinking of the Empress of Ireland and the 1958 Spring Hill, Nova Scotia mining disaster. Due to time limitations and the extent to which I see similarities between Westray and the 1982 Ocean Ranger oil rig tragedy off the coast of Newfoundland, in which 84 were killed, and I mentioned them in my abstract too, I will discuss Westray in depth, but we'll leave discussion of the Ocean Ranger to the question period. I picked these four events because they each inspired more disaster songs than almost any other event in my database, which I took as a possible indication of cultural trauma. In working with these four disasters, it became clear that two could not be considered cultural traumas, while two probably could. In this paper, I explain how I came to these conclusions and the role that songs played in reaching them. At about 2 a.m. on May 29, 1914, close to Rimouski, Quebec, a sudden fog descended, and in the thick fog, the Canadian Pacific passenger liner Empress of Ireland, carrying 1,477 passengers and crew, was struck by the Norwegian steamer Storstad, ripping a 7.5-meter hole in the Empress. The Empress sank in 14 minutes. Most people had no chance of escape, and 1,012 people died. Alexander suggests that there are four main ingredients required for a cultural trauma: a traumatic event, victims, identification of those responsible, and most importantly, a sense of how the event is significant to people beyond the victims directly affected. In the case of the Empress, it's clear what the trauma is and who the victims are, the more than 1,000 lives lost when the Empress sank. It is somewhat less clear who was responsible. The captains of both ships blamed the other. But for there to be a cultural trauma, a group of people not directly involved in the trauma needs to feel that that event in some way affected them and continues to affect them. For example, musicologist Eric Hung writes about how Asian Americans are traumatized by the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Sociologist Ron Ironman argues that African Americans are traumatized by slavery. And sociologist Neil Smelser argues that Americans are traumatized by 9/11. In the case of the Empress, there is no larger group obviously affected by the Empress, and especially not in terms of collective identity. Although I know of 10 songs about the Empress, as well as a whole 2008 album of new compositions dedicated to the disaster, almost all have been written by people who are at some distance from the event. Some composers publish sheet music at the time of the event to capitalize on the broadsheet industry. Other songs were composed much more recently, mostly by history buffs who wanted to draw attention to a significant but forgotten moment in Canadian history. These songs call upon audiences to remember, but they don't encourage audiences to identify with a particular wronged group, nor do they function as a call to action. Therefore, I do not see the tragedy of the Empress of Ireland as a cultural trauma. The Spring Hill, Nova Scotia mining disaster of 1958, by contrast, had considerable potential as a cultural trauma. Spring Hill has a long history of mining and an equally long history of mining tragedy. On October 23, 1958, a bump, which is an earthquake-like geological event, killed 75 people. Miraculously, two groups of survivors were later rescued. 12 were rescued after a week surviving underground, and an additional 7 were rescued 2 days after that. The unfolding story riveted people from all over the world, receiving unparalleled international news coverage. The discovery of two groups of survivors so long after the bump added a miraculous twist, providing a feel-good element and differentiating the story from so many other mining tragedies. The event remained in people's minds as the survivors subsequently appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and were later invited for a high-profile, all-expenses-paid holiday by the state of Georgia. A heritage minute about one of the survivors, Maurice Ruddock, aired in the 1990s. Numerous histories and academic studies of the event have also appeared. In many ways, Spring Hill 58 has all the characteristics typical of a cultural trauma. The unexpectedness, suddenness, and horrible consequences shocked not just the local community, but Canadians across the country and beyond. There were numerous collective behavior reactions as the community came together to wait at the pithead, and people around the world sent many for a miners' relief fund, raising $2 million. Widespread collective mourning. A sense of the indelibility of the trauma, not least because it was the third major disaster to strike the mines in Spring Hill. Deliberate efforts to remember the event collectively, such as anniversary memorials. Sustained public interest in the remembering process, as indicated by books, songs, and the Heritage Minute appearing throughout the last several decades. And a culminating sense that Spring Hill and miners' identities had been altered fundamentally. The subsequent and rapid decline of the local mining industry resulted in widespread unemployment, poverty, and outmigration, and threatened the town of Spring Hill's very existence. However, I was struck by the extent to which the event has been commemorated less as a trauma and more as a miracle. Much of the literature about Spring Hill 58 has emphasized the miraculous rescue of the 19 survivors, diverting attention away from the loss of 75 others. For example, the first history of the Spring Hill 58 disaster published was entitled Miracle at Spring Hill, and another published 23 years later was entitled Miracle Town. Jack Kingston, an Ontario country singer, wrote a song about the 58 disaster called Miracle at Colliery 2. Maurice Ruddock, one of the survivors, was named Canada's Citizen of the Year, and all the survivors were given medals for heroism. In short, the event seems to be represented more often as a feel-good event than as a cultural trauma. And yet, songs written about Spring Hill 58 reveal an ambivalent attitude toward the disaster. And I must note that I'm indebted to folklorist Neil Rosenberg for the work he published on Spring Hill songs, which informs much of this section. I know of three songs written in the immediate aftermath of the 58 disaster. Kingston's, as mentioned, frames the event as miraculous, although it's also worth noting that it wasn't released until 1971. And I won't be playing any music in this paper just because of time issues, but the paper that follows me, Chris McDonald, will be talking about some of the disaster songs I talk about here. A second song, The Spring Hill Mine Disaster, was recorded and released by American bluegrass band Bill Clifton and the Dixie Mountain Boys. Clifton's song is based, with permission, on a poem Ruddock wrote shortly after his rescue, and Ruddock has co-author credit. Written from the perspective of one of the trapped miners, the song describes surviving in a black hell, and it paints quite a bleak picture of the experience underground. But the song ends with gratitude for their rescue, and the major key waltz time arrangement sounds more like a conventional love song than a tragic story. The third is Peggy Seeger's famous song, The Ballad of Spring Hill. The song describes the mines as graves that the miners dig for themselves. Although Seeger's ballad makes reference to the rescued miners, she portrays their ordeal as horrific, essentially buried alive and surviving in the dark next to the corpses of their co-workers. Unlike other song composers of the time, Seeger is careful not to overshadow the horror of the event with the excitement of the miraculous rescue of 19 miners. Of course, this isn't surprising, as Seeger was active in bringing attention to the often deplorable labor conditions of the blue-collar working class. But while Seeger's song, and to a lesser extent Clifton and Ruddock's song, attest to the terrifying experiences of trapped miners and the horrendous price many miners pay for their work, They have done little to counter the far more pervasive tendency to treat Spring Hill 58 more as a moment to celebrate and wonder at than as a tragic moment in the history of Canada, one from which lessons should be learned to prevent similar tragedies in the future. Even later songs, some of which point out the long-term repercussions of the event, including the collapse of the mining industry in Spring Hill and the poverty and unemployment faced by many who remained in the community, do not identify a specific antagonist, nor are there demands for restitution. The contrasts with the Ocean Ranger and West Ranger disasters are striking. In 1992, 26 miners were killed in an explosion at the Westray mine in Pictou County, Nova Scotia. Unlike the 58 Spring Hill disaster, Westray has become central to the identity of provincial miners. The tragedy occurred only a few years before the last subsurface coal mine in Nova Scotia closed in 2001, and it was the last major mine disaster in the province. Due to many technological innovations in mining and improved safety regulations, many were shocked that such a disaster was even possible in late 20th century Canada. Mining as a whole is central to the identity of many Nova Scotians and Nova Scotia communities, even now that it is no longer an active industry. Westray, only about 150 kilometers away from Spring Hill, could not be characterized more differently than the 58 Spring Hill disaster. Westray became a touch point for anger about corporate greed and political collusion coming at the expense of average people's lives. The Westray mine opened in 1991, and only 8 months later, a preventable explosion killed all 26 miners working at the time. Although the facilities were supposed to be state of the art, and the mine actually won a safety award only 1 month before the disaster, the resulting public inquiry revealed that safety regulations were deliberately ignored by both mine management and government inspectors interested in maximizing production and profits and improving the economy of the area. The RCMP charged the general manager and underground manager with criminal negligence and manslaughter, charges that were dropped due to what many saw as sloppy police work and jurisdictional problems. The mining company and provincial government blamed the tragedy on the miners' failure to follow safety protocols, but Justice Richards' report indicated a range of factors worked together to result in the Westray tragedy. In particular, he clearly indicated that there were systemic problems in Canadian government, law, and corporate business, and specifically at the Westray mine, that resulted in the predictable disaster. Westray received significant news coverage, which was sustained over several years, as various charges were laid and dropped, and as the public inquiry got underway, portions of which were televised nationally. Other factors complementing the media coverage have also played a role in relating Westray to a broader audience, and one of the preconditions required in the formulation of a cultural trauma. The report of the public inquiry set the scene for the creation of the Westray Bill, Bill C-45, which holds corporations, their executives, and directors criminally responsible for negligence and was passed into law in 2003. Westray inspired considerable academic research, published in numerous journals and books. The Westray Families Group was formed to commemorate their loved ones, resulting in a memorial park and monument. But the Westray Families Group also has a No More Westrays mission and has consequently collaborated with labor and community organizations to promote workplace safety and legislative change. This kind of activism indicates that the impact of Westray has moved far beyond the individual families most directly affected by the disaster. Westray inspired an array of books, articles, poems, a National Film Board documentary, and of course, songs. I know of 27 songs about Westray, the greatest number of songs for any event except for the Titanic, but only about 7 to 11 of them seem to have been written in the immediate aftermath of the disaster. There's 4 songs that I can't date confidently. The remaining 16 to 20 songs seem to have been written in the 20 years since Westray, with 1 or 2 appearing every year or so. The ongoing resonance of the event is evident in the many Westray songs written across Canada, from Nova Scotia to Manitoba to Yukon. A significant number, however, are from Nova Scotia and speak to anger about the event's causes. The Westray tragedy has come to be seen as an example of what happens when corporate greed and political ambition go uncontrolled. Alexander says that the cultural trauma process requires that the nature of the pain be defined. quote, what actually happened to the particular group and the wider collectivity of which it is a part, end quote. Westray killed 26 men, but it could have killed any of the other miners working there, or any of the miners working in almost any other mine across Canada, or any other working in unsafe conditions for the sake of a buck. The results of the public inquiry and the Westray bill both speak to the fact that Westray was not seen as an idiosyncratic one-off event, but rather an illustration of the logical consequences of systemic problems found in industry and politics throughout the nation. Alexander argues that a cultural trauma also defines the nature of the victim and attributes responsibility. Although the earliest Westray songs tend, not surprisingly, to focus on the tragic loss of life, later songs definitely signal blame and articulate the larger social significance of the event. So I'll just go through a couple. These are not all of them. Sarah Harmer's song Westray, a natural disaster comes out, wasn't natural after all, and 1 year later it has yet to come clear. No one's doing anything because they're scared of the way they might appear. They're ignoring all the signals they could not afford to hear, private investors in public fear. Garnet Rogers, the mine and the tower stand as symbols of greed. You're just profit and loss here in Colliertown. The lawyers talk smoothly for the 6 o'clock news. Here in Colliertown, only the innocent lose. And Sandy McLean, who's an amateur songwriter from Cape Breton. When the government inspectors were down in the mine, they ignored all the coal dust and the shortage of lime, and the methane detectors that were screwed up, they say. So 26 men died down in Westray that day. Some high politicians, at first they did cry, but their greatest concern was to cover their hides, and the rot in the system meant that no one would pay. Our courts, they did fail us so badly that way. The bosses and the owners, they walked away free, thumbing their noses at the inquiry, but someday in heaven before God's great throne, there'll be no escaping when sins are atoned. But perhaps most importantly, the cultural trauma process establishes the relationship between the trauma victims and the wider audience such that, quote, the audience for trauma representations experience an identity with the immediately victimized group, end quote. Songs offer great potential for reaching broad audiences, and their affective qualities mean that they can help forge a sense of emotional connection. Although I can't speak for the ways in which audiences receive and make sense of disaster songs, I do ask songwriters in interviews who they're writing for and why they decided to write a disaster song, as well as why they picked the particular disaster that they wrote about. Al Hannis, who composed Pictou County Mining Disaster, who's from Manitoba, explained that he was drawn to the story as a working man himself. It's a horrifying thing. Stuff like that shouldn't happen. I mean, I'm a working man. To me, it just seemed like it was something that mattered, that should be written about. Many people came up to me after hearing me play at a coffee house to say good things about that song. So I knew that I'd done something that was reaching people. When I wrote it, yeah, I was just trying to reach the common person, people just like me, because it affected me, the whole story. And Sandy McLean from Cape Breton, who I just quoted his song, worked on the Westray scene as a telecommunications specialist, and he explained why he composed his song, Westray Remembered. I was very involved in the labor movement. I was president of the union that represented the telephone workers at the time, so I think probably I took a perspective from the workers' point in the song. Perhaps the song was based on some of that, my own experience. The song was also for anyone in the future that would be falling into the same trap where you cut corners and safety and, you know, work is hard to come by in Cape Breton and Eastern Nova Scotia. And some companies come in and they have a way of manipulating the government. And not only that, there's been companies that have been here for a long time that do the same thing. But safety's not always given the priority that it should. Both Al Hannis's and Sandy McLean's comments clearly illustrate that they feel implicated in the Westray tragedy despite being neither miners and neither being directly affected by the disaster. They also feel that the Westray story, as articulated in their songs, is relevant to others who may also have little direct connection to the event. Most importantly, for the cultural trauma process, they feel connected by virtue of a shared work experience, one defined by unions and blue-collar jobs rather than specifically by coal mining. So, conclusions. This paper offered me the opportunity to work through a definition of cultural trauma by attempting to apply it to various Atlantic Canadian disasters, paying particular attention to the role of songs in defining or predicting cultural trauma. The key characteristic of a cultural trauma is its construction as a rallying point around which a particular group coalesces and identifies, which can take some time to occur. For this reason, it seems clear that disasters about which several songs are made, especially if they were made over a period of time and not just in the immediate aftermath of an event, certainly are one indication of a cultural trauma, as they indicate the possibility that an event has become a touch point for a particular group of people. However, as I found in examining the songs written about the Empress, the 58 Spring Hill disaster, the 1982 Ocean Ranger tragedy, and the 92 Westray explosion, it is also important to consider songs within a larger context of other responses to a given event, as well as to the way in which the event is portrayed. Thus, although each of the four disasters I mentioned in this paper inspired a large number of disaster songs, only two seem to have become central to a group's identity. In the case of Westray, it has become central to the narrative of the Nova Scotia mining community specifically, but also of the province more generally, and indeed even for Canadian working classes. If I'd had more time, I would have given more attention to how songs compare to other responses to each of the disasters discussed, such as books, documentaries, scholarly studies, etc. However, at this point, I just welcome your feedback. Thank you. Lean?
Thank you for that, Heather. By coincidence, Westray is something that I've covered in my seminars on memory. One of the ways in which that, as you call it, the trauma, is portrayed and discussed is really, has been really discussed highly in terms of a production of counter memory. So I was wondering, how would you see the songs, because some of the songs that we saw the lyrics of, for me, were really part of suggesting not the history that lots of one would expect coming from the point of view of the so-called responsible, playing on these narratives where you change the perspective upon which the story is being told, thus producing these kinds of counter-memory narratives. So I was wondering to what extent these songs have this in common as to sort of flipping sides, or as one of your respondents said, taking sides.
Sorry, I just want to clarify, what do you mean by counter-memory?
In most cases, it's just considered when you have some kind of official narrative. Official meaning could mean totally different things.
Right.
The official could be coming from in the case of Westray, it was at first the government, and then after that it was the miners, after that it was. But this notion that there's an hegemonic narrative that establishes, and at the same time is always being challenged by these counter memories.
Okay. Yeah, no, one of the issues that I want to talk about with disaster songs, another paper, is the issue of themes of fatalism, actually. So earlier disaster songs quite frequently attribute it all to fate and God, and very much say that these things are things that we couldn't really help. And there, it's really only very, very recently, and I would say Westray is the most obvious and poignant example, that we start to see blame. But it's not just Westray. I mean, Westray is one, is probably the strongest example that I have, but Ocean Ranger is another one, and that was 10 years prior. And for example, the 2009 helicopter crash, I don't know if you remember that, 18 people, they went down, they were off of Newfoundland and they were going to an oil rig, and the helicopter went down and 17 people died. There's quite a bit of blame around that. So I think that there's some issues around the social ideas about when is it okay to blame. And, you know, I think earlier in the 20th century, it was about fate, and there wasn't a feeling that it was that there was some agency for people who were making songs and the workers to have some say in what was going on. And then I think we start to see through the 60s, with a rise in activism and all sorts of different rights movements, that we start to see the shift in disaster songs. And then Westray becomes a particularly good example. And I would say too that the earliest songs, and I think this is also really common, is the earliest songs, so the songs that came out sort of like right after, don't talk about blame. And I think that's because it's not the time for blame, it's the time for grieving. And in fact, sort of this tendency to think of everybody as kind of united in a common grief becomes this sort of trope from those earliest songs, and then it starts to shift as some time goes past and more details come out.
just full on abstract to me thinking about reductions. There's kind of three kinds of characters that emerge in the different ones you showed. There's heroes,
yeah,
victims, and villains. And it struck me that none of your examples seem to have all three. It seemed to be kind of, you know, the West Rite seemed to skew towards victims and villains. Ship disaster didn't have necessarily a villain at all. And of course the heroes have dominated the earlier ones. Have you come across pieces that might contain all three characters within one kind of narrative?
I have to think about that. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. I'm actually heading to the Canadian Society for Traditional Music conference next weekend, and I'm talking about masculinities, and I'm talking about the construction of men, particularly in the songs, in terms of villains, in terms of heroes, just the way they're being gendered. And actually, one of the things that I found really interesting is I assumed that the victims would generally be characterized as heroes, but in fact, they may be, but actually just as often they're kind of portrayed as quite weak characters as opposed to the rescue workers. So in mining, that would be draggermen that are often characterized as heroes. So it becomes, there's another character, I guess, in the songs as well. So I'd have to think a little bit about how many different kinds of characters show up in any given song. It's a really interesting question. I do think that one of the things that strikes me is that songs are short. Usually they're really short. So we're talking maybe, there are exceptions, but a lot of them are maybe five verses or something. There's not a lot that can be said in five verses. And so that may force a certain restriction in terms of the number of characters that can reasonably show up. The other thing is that I'm looking at amateur songwriters as well as commercially successful songwriters. And the amateur songwriters have a tendency to write in a very kind of template style song. So I can tell you pretty much what I'm expecting to see from an amateur songwriter. So there's gonna be a verse that says, here's the date, here's the place, here's, and then there's a verse on, here's what happened. And then there's a verse that we're all sad and there's heroes that were involved in trying to rescue them. And then there's a verse that's on the women who are crying and the children who are now orphaned. And then there's a, you know, praise God and it's all, you know, we're going to leave it with God's hands and da da da. And so I think too that that template might also constrain the kinds of characters that would show up in songs. And then the more commercially successful artists tend to individualize themselves. So they try to do something a little different from that template. And so I think that's where there might be some more variation. But that's a really interesting question. I'll take a look at my songs and think about that some more. Thanks. Jacqueline?
Yeah, interesting stuff as always. I've heard some of these songs and I know that most of them have that kind of folk aesthetic to them. And it strikes me that the kinds of disasters they're talking about, mines and ships, those are sort of old-fashioned disasters and lend itself well to that kind of old-fashioned, folky, oldie-time music style. And I'm wondering, A, are there songs about, say, the Swiss airplane crash, for example, and B, if so, do they have a different musical vocabulary?
And yes, there are. And so if anybody's interested, the Disaster Songs Project has a website. It's just disastersongs.ca. You're welcome to go and take a look. And there are, it's not as many, but there are some about Swissair. There's about the Cougar helicopter crash. There's there was a Gander flight crash at the military base, actually, in 1985. So there's some songs about that. So air crashes do get a few songs, lesser about other, interestingly, very few railway disasters because they're really prominent in the States, but less so apparently out in Atlantic Canada. But by far the most common songs are shipwreck songs, usually fishing shipwreck songs, but also some passenger liner songs, and then the mining songs are the other big ones. I haven't thought about whether there are patterns according to the kinds of disasters. Certainly the majority of them follow a certain kind of tendency, a certain kind of pattern. So the shipwreck and the mining that do share a lot of similarities. So I'd have to take a look at the air disaster songs and just think about how they're being described and how the song is being used, especially because those tend to be more contemporary songs. And so they're probably already coming out of that sort of that sense of music needing to be different and unique. And yeah, thanks. I'll think about that too. Thank you.
Another question. This is not well formed, Heather. I really enjoyed this, but I was reflecting on the resonances between the songs that you were talking about today and the songs actually that you were talking about yesterday, Heather, with Tony Lee, and the ways that you were talking about labor activism, about songs being very instrumental, as a way to convey ideas shortly. And, you know, I was honestly introduced to repertories I was unaware of, and the way that these songs really did things and really criticized and really, you know, created specific villains. And I just wonder, Heather, if you could talk a little bit about how does that, I mean, your framework about cultural trauma makes so much sense to me, and I just wonder how you can talk about what these songs do, and maybe what they do differently than union organizing type songs that are aimed at, you know, sustaining spirits on a picket line, for example. What does a disaster song do differently, or, you know, does it accomplish anything?
I have to think about that some more as well. That's somewhere that I haven't really gone with this research yet. But I think that what I see that makes talking about disaster songs both so interesting but so complicated is that, like, what's holding that as a group of songs together? Like, it's just a topic, right? So there's middle class people and there's working class people and there's women and there's men and there's young and there's old and there's people who've got direct experience in these communities with experiencing the tragedies and people who have no experience with those tragedies. So it becomes difficult to talk about what is the song, what are these songs doing, depending on like who's making these songs and where are they circulating. I do think though that because there are people who are involved in these songs that aren't just in the sort of union, say, circles, that the songs move far out of that, those sort of directly involved communities. And I think that it has the potential to help people to identify with a tragedy or a disaster who might not otherwise feel that they're connected to it. That's my instinct. And I have nothing to tell you that supports that really at this point, but that's what I think I would try to follow and see if that led to something more substantial to tell you.
Thanks. And we can probably continue this part of the discussion with Chris's paper.
Sure. Thank you.